Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week is my 100th episode, and it is a special one. I've gathered a collection of Christmas classics for your holiday enjoyment. The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry, The Little Match Girl by Hans Christian Andersen, Twas the Night Before Christmas by Clement Moore, as well as stories by Tolstoy, Saki, and more. Some you may know, some you may not, but they are all sweet, bittersweet, fun, and touching stories. KPCA, who hosts my radio show and broadcast, is airing special broadcasts to be played while touring the Christmas lights around my hometown. This is my contribution. I hope you enjoy them. And Merry Christmas. And now, The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. $1.87. That was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher, until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealings implied. 3 times Della counted it. $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing left to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it, which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beg description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 per week. Now, when the income was shrunk to 20, the letters of Dillingham looked blurred, as though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim, and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her crying and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out, dully, at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him. Something fine and rare and sterling. Something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very fragile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly, she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there are 2 possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out of the window some day to dry, just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor, with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed, just to see him pluck his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her, rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again, nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, on went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she cluttered out of the door and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, "Madame Sofroni, Hair Goods of All Kinds." 1-8 up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madame, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked like the Sofroni.
"Will you buy my hair?" asked Della.
"I buy hair," said Madame. "Take your hat off and let's have a sight at the looks of it."
Down rippled the brown cascade.
$20,
said Madame, lifting the mass with a practiced hand.
"Give it to me quick," said Della.
Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value, the description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with her 87 cents. With that chain upon his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas, and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes her hair was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror, long, carefully, and critically.
"If Jim doesn't kill me," she said to herself, "before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87?
At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the hot stove and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his steps on the stair away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying little silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I'm still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked very thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stepped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her, fixedly, with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him.
"Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold it because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again. You don't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a nice, what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you.
You've cut off your hair?
Asked Jim, laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor.
Cut it off and sold it, said Della.
Don't you like me just as well anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I? Jim looked about the room curiously.
You say your hair is gone?
He said with an air of almost idiocy.
You needn't look for it, Jim, said Della. It's sold, I tell you. Sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you.
Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered. She went on with a sudden serious sweetness. But nobody could ever count my love for you.
Shall I put the chops on, Jim?
Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week, or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat and threw it upon the table.
Don't make any mistake, Del, he said, about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first.
White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy, and then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the Flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped for long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure turquoise shell, with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful, vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers. But the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped like a little singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at it 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Del," said he, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep 'em a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now suppose you put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of 2 foolish children in a flat, who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these 2 were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are the wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the Magi. And now, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas by Clement C. Moore.
'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With the little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they met with an obstacle, mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of his pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work, and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to the sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night." And now, The Little Match Girl by Hans Christian Andersen. Most terribly cold it was. It snowed and was nearly quite dark, and evening, the last evening of the year. In this cold and darkness, there went along the street a poor little girl, bareheaded and with naked feet. When she left home, she had slippers on, it is true. But what was the good of that? They were very large slippers, which her mother had hitherto worn. So large were they, and the poor little thing lost them as she scuffled away across the street because of 2 carriages that rolled by dreadfully fast. One slipper was nowhere to be found. The other had been laid hold of by an urchin, and off he ran with it. He thought it would do capitally for a cradle when he some day or other should have children himself. So the little maiden walked on with her tiny naked feet. They were quite red and blue from the cold. She carried a quantity of matches in an old apron, and she held a bundle of them in her hand. Nobody had bought anything of her the whole livelong day. No one had given her a single farthing. She crept along, trembling with cold and hunger, a very picture of sorrow, poor little thing. The snowflakes of snow covered her long fair hair, which fell in beautiful curls around her neck. But of that, of course, she never once now thought. From all the windows the candles were gleaming, and it smelt so deliciously of roast goose, for you know it was New Year's Eve. Yes, of that she thought. In a corner, formed by 2 houses, of which one advanced more than the other, she seated herself down and cowered together. Her little feet she had drawn close up to her, but she grew colder and colder, and to go home she did not venture, for she had not sold any matches and could not bring a farthing of money. From her father she would certainly get blows, and at home it was cold too, for above her she had only the roof through which the wind whistled, even though the large cracks were stopped up with straw and rags. Her little hands were almost numbed with cold. Oh, a match might afford her a world of comfort. If she only dare take a single one out of the bundle, draw it against the wall, and warm her fingers by it. She drew one out. How it blazed, how it burnt! It was a warm, bright flame, like a candle, as she held her hands over it. It was a wonderful light. It seemed really to the little maiden as though she were sitting before a large iron stove with burnished brass feet and a brass ornament atop. The fire burned with such blessed influence. It warmed so delightfully. The little girl had already stretched out her feet to warm them too. But the flame went out. The small flame went out. The stove vanished. She had only the remains of the burned-out match in her hand. She rubbed another against the wall. It burned brightly, and where the light fell on the wall, there the wall became transparent like a veil, so that she could see into the room. On the table was spread a snow-white tablecloth. Upon it was a splendid porcelain service, and the roast goose was steaming famously with its stuffing of apple and dried plums. But what was still more capital to behold was the goose hopped down from the dish, reeled about on the floor with a knife and fork in its breast, till it came up to the poor little girl, when the match went out and nothing but the thick, cold, damp wall was left behind. She lighted another match. Now there she was, sitting under the most magnificent Christmas tree. It was still larger and more decorated than the one she had seen through the glass door in the rich merchant's house. Thousands of lights were burning on the green branches, and gaily colored pictures, such as she had seen in the shop windows, looked down upon her. The little maiden stretched out her hands toward them when the match went out. The lights of the Christmas tree rose higher and higher. She saw them now as stars in heaven. One fell down and formed a long trail of fire. "Someone is just dead," said the little girl. For her old grandmother, the only person who had ever loved her and who was now no more, had told her that when a star falls, a soul ascends to God. She drew another match against the wall. It was again light, and in the luster there stood the old grandmother, so bright and radiant, so mild, and with such an expression of love. "Grandmother," cried the little one, "oh, take me with you. You go away when the match burns out. You vanish like the warm stove, like the delicious roast goose, and like the magnificent Christmas tree." And she rubbed the whole bundle of matches quickly against the wall, for she wanted to be quite sure of keeping her grandmother near her. And the matches gave such a brilliant light that it was brighter than a noonday. Never formerly had the grandmother been so beautiful and so tall. She took the little maiden on her arm, and both flew in brightness and in joy, so high, so very high, and then above was neither cold, nor hunger, nor anxiety. They were with God. But in the corner, at the cold hour of dawn, sat the poor girl, with rosy cheeks and with a smiling mouth, leaning against the wall, frozen to death on the last evening of the old year. Stiff and dark sat the girl there with her matches, of which one bundle had been burnt. She wanted to warm herself, people said. No one had the slightest suspicion of what beautiful things she had seen. No one ever dreamed of the splendor in which, with her grandmother, she had entered on the joys of a new year. And now, Christmas Bells, by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I heard the bells on Christmas Day, their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet the words repeat of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And thought how, as the day had come, the belfries of all Christendom had rolled along the unbroken song of peace on earth, goodwill to men, till ringing and singing on its way, the world revolved from night to day, a voice, a chime, a chant sublime, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then, from each black accursed mouth, the cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound the carols drowned of peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearthstones of a continent and made forlorn the households born of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. And now, Jimmy Scarecrow's Christmas by Mary E. Wilkins Freeman. Jimmy Scarecrow led a sad life in the winter. Jimmy's greatest grief was his lack of occupation. He liked to be useful, and in winter he was absolutely of no use at all. He wondered how many such miserable winters he would have to endure. He was a young scarecrow, and this was his first one. He was strongly made, and although his wooden joints creaked a little when the wind blew, he did not grow in the least rickety. Every morning, when the wintry sun peered like a hard yellow eye across the dry corn stubble, Jimmy felt sad. But at Christmas time, his heart nearly broke. On Christmas Eve, Santa Claus came in his sled heaped high with presents, urging his team of reindeer across the field. He was on his way to the farmhouse where Betsy lived with her Aunt Hannah. Betsy was a very good little girl with smooth yellow curls, and she had a great many presents. Santa Claus had a large wax doll baby for her on his arm, tucked up against the fur collar of his coat. He was afraid to trust it in the pack, lest it get broken. When poor Jimmy Scarecrow saw Santa Claus, his heart gave a great leap. "Santa Claus, here I am!" he cried out, but Santa Claus did not hear him. "Santa Claus, please give me a little present. I was good all summer and kept the crows out of the corn," pleaded the poor scarecrow in his choking voice. But Santa Claus passed by with a merry halloo and a great clamor of bells. Then Jimmy Scarecrow stood in the corn stubble and shook with sobs until his joints creaked. "I am of no use in the world, and everybody has forgotten me," he moaned. But he was mistaken. The next morning, Betsy sat at the window holding her Christmas doll baby, and she looked out at Jimmy Scarecrow, standing alone in the field amidst the corn stubble. "Aunt Hannah," said she. Aunt Hannah was making a crazy patchwork quilt, and she frowned hard at a triangular piece of red silk and a circular piece of pink, wondering how to fit them together. "Well," said she, "did Santa Claus bring the Scarecrow any Christmas present?" "No, of course he didn't."
"Why not?"
"Because he's a scarecrow. Don't ask silly questions."
"I wouldn't like to be treated so if I was a scarecrow," said Betsy. But her Aunt Hannah did not hear her. She was busy cutting a triangular snip out of the round piece of pink silk, so the piece of red silk could be feather-stitched into it. It was snowing hard out of doors, and the north wind blew. The scarecrow's poor old coat got whiter and whiter with snow. Sometimes he almost vanished in the thick white storm. But Aunt Hannah worked until the middle of the afternoon on her crazy quilt. Then she got up and spread it out over the sofa with an air of pride.
"There," said she, "that's done, and that makes the 8th. I've got one for every bed in the house, and I've given 4 away.
I'd give this away if I knew of anybody that wanted it.
Aunt Hannah put on her hood and shawl and drew some blue yarn stockings on over her shoes and set out through the snow to carry a slice of plum pudding to her sister Susan, who lived down the road. Half an hour after Aunt Hannah had gone, Betsy put her little red plaid shawl over her head and ran across the field to Jimmy Scarecrow. She carried her new doll baby snuggled under her shawl.
"Wish you a Merry Christmas," she said to Jimmy Scarecrow.
"Wish you the same," said Jimmy, but his voice was choked with sobs and was also muffled, for his old hat had slipped down to his chin. Betsy looked pitifully at the old hat, fringed with icicles like frozen tears, and the old snow-laden coat.
"I've brought you a Christmas present," said she, and with that she tucked her doll baby inside Jimmy Scarecrow's coat, sticking its tiny feet into a pocket.
"Thank you," said Jimmy Scarecrow, faintly.
"You're welcome," said she. "Keep her under your overcoat so the snow won't wet her, and she won't catch cold. She's delicate."
"Yes, I will," said Jimmy Scarecrow, and he tried hard to bring one of his stiff, outstretched arms around to clasp the doll baby.
"Don't you feel cold in that old summer coat?" asked Betsy.
"If I had a little exercise, I should be warm," he replied, but he shivered, and the wind whistled through his rags.
"You wait a minute," said Betsy, and was off across the field.
Jimmy Scarecrow stood in the corn stubble with the doll baby under his coat and waited, and soon Betsy was back again with Aunt Hannah's crazy quilt trailing in the snow behind her.
"Here," said she, "here is something to keep you warm,"
and she folded the crazy quilt around the Scarecrow and pinned it.
"Aunt Hannah wants to give it away if anybody wants it," she explained. "She's got so many crazy quilts in the house now, she doesn't know what to do with them. Goodbye. Be sure you keep the doll baby covered up."
And with that, she ran across the field and left Jimmy Scarecrow alone with the crazy quilt and the doll baby. The bright flash of colors under Jimmy's hat brim dazzled his eyes, and he felt a little alarmed.
"I hope this quilt is harmless, if it is crazy," he said.
But the quilt was warm, and he dismissed his fears. Soon the doll baby whimpered, but he creaked his joints a little, and that amused it, and he heard it cooing inside his coat. Jimmy Scarecrow had never felt so happy in his life as he did for an hour or so. But after that, the snow began to turn to rain, and the crazy quilt was soaked through and through. And not only that, but his coat and the poor doll baby. It cried pitifully for a while, and then it was still, and he was afraid it was dead. It grew very dark, and the rain fell in sheets. The snow melted, and Jimmy Scarecrow stood halfway up his old boots in water. He was saying to himself that the saddest hour of his life had come, when suddenly he heard again Santa Claus' sleigh bells and his merry voice talking to his reindeer. It was after midnight, Christmas was over, and Santa was hastening home to the North Pole.
"Santa Claus! Dear Santa Claus!" cried Jimmy Scarecrow with a great sob,
and that time Santa Claus heard him and drew rein.
"Who's there?"
he shouted out of the darkness.
"It's only me,"
replied the Scarecrow.
"Who's me?" shouted Santa Claus.
"Jimmy Scarecrow."
Santa got out of his sled and waded up.
"Have you been standing here ever since corn was ripe?"
he asked pityingly, and Jimmy replied that he had.
"What's that over your shoulders?"
Santa Claus continued, holding up his lantern.
"It's a crazy quilt."
"And what are you holding under your coat?"
"The doll baby that Betsy gave me, and I'm afraid it's dead." Poor Jimmy Scarecrow sobbed.
"Nonsense!" cried Santa Claus. "Let me see it."
And with that, he pulled the doll baby out from under the Scarecrow's coat and patted its back and shook it a little, and it began to cry and then to crow.
"It's all right," said Santa Claus. "This is the doll baby I gave Betsy, and it is not at all delicate. It went through the measles and the chicken pox and the mumps and the whooping cough before it left the North Pole. Now get into the sled, Jimmy Scarecrow, and bring the baby doll and the crazy quilt. I have never had any quilts that weren't in their right minds at the North Pole, but maybe I can cure this one. Get in!
Santa chirped to his reindeer, and they drew the sled up close in a beautiful curve.
Get in, Jimmy Scarecrow, and come with me to the North Pole, he cried.
Please, how long shall I stay? Asked Jimmy Scarecrow.
Why, you are going to live with me, replied Santa Claus. I've been looking for a person like you for a long time.
Are there any crows to scare away at the North Pole? I want to be useful, Jimmy Scarecrow said anxiously.
No, answered Santa Claus, but I don't want you to scare away crows. I want you to scare away Arctic explorers. I can keep you in work for 1,000 years, and scaring away Arctic explorers from the North Pole is much more important than scaring away crows from corn. Why, if they've found the pole, there wouldn't be a piece an inch long left in a week's time, and the earth would cave in like an apple without a core. They would whittle it all to pieces and carry it away in their pockets for souvenirs. Come along, I'm in a hurry.
I will go on 2 conditions, said Jimmy. First, I want to make a present to Aunt Hannah and Betsy next Christmas.
You shall make them any present you choose. What else?
I want some way provided to scare the crows out of the corn next summer while I'm away, said Jimmy.
That's easily managed, said Santa Claus. Just wait a minute.
Santa took his stylographic pen out of his pocket, went with his lantern close to one of the fence posts, and wrote these words upon it. Notice to crows. Whichever crow shall hereafter hop, fly, or flop into this field during the absence of Jimmy Scarecrow, and therefrom purloin, steal, or abstract corn, shall be instantly, in a twinkling and a trice, turned snow white, and be ever after a disgrace, a byword, and a reproach to his whole race, per order of Santa Claus.
The corn will be safe now, said Santa Claus. Get in!
Jimmy got into the sled and flew away over the fields, out of sight, with merry halloos and a great clamor of bells. The next morning, there was much surprise at the farmhouse when Aunt Hannah and Betsy looked out of the window and the Scarecrow was not in the field holding out his stiff arms over the corn stubble. Betsy told Aunt Hannah she had given away the crazy quilt and the doll baby, but had been scolded very little.
"You must not give away anything of yours again without asking permission," said Aunt Hannah. "And you have no right to give anything of mine, even if you know I don't want it. Now both my pretty quilt and your beautiful doll baby are spoiled."
That was all Aunt Hannah had said. She thought she would send John after the quilt and the doll baby next morning, as soon as it was light. But Jimmy Scarecrow was gone, and the crazy quilt and the doll baby with him. John, the servant man, searched everywhere, but not a trace of them could he find.
"They must have all blown away, Mum," he said to Aunt Hannah.
"We shall have to have another scarecrow next summer," said she. But the next summer there was no need of a scarecrow, for not a crow came past the fence post on which Santa had written his notice to crows. The cornfield was never so beautiful, and not a single grain was stolen by a crow, and everybody wondered at it, for they could not read the crow language in which Santa had written.
"It is a great mystery to me why the crows don't come into our cornfield when there is no scarecrow," said Aunt Hannah.
But she had a still greater mystery to solve when Christmas came round again. Then she and Betsy had each a strange present. They found them in the sitting room on Christmas morning. Aunt Hannah's present was her old crazy quilt, remodeled, with every piece cut square and true, and matched exactly to its neighbor.
"Why, it's my old crazy quilt! But it isn't crazy now," cried Aunt Hannah, and her very spectacles seemed to glisten with amazement.
Betsy's present was her doll baby of the Christmas before, but the doll was a year older. She had grown an inch, and could walk and say, "Mama," and "How do?" She was changed a good deal, but Betsy knew her at once.
"It's my doll baby," she cried, and snatched her up and kissed her.
But neither Aunt Hannah nor Betsy ever knew that the quilt and the doll were Jimmy Scarecrow's Christmas presents to them. And now, Reginald's Christmas Revel by H.H. Monroe, a.k.a. Saki. "They say," said Reginald, "that there's nothing sadder than victory except defeat. If you've ever stayed with dull people during what is alleged to be the festive season, you can probably revise that saying. I shall never forget putting in a Christmas at the Babwalds. Mrs. Babwald is some relation of my father's, a sort of to-be-left-till-called-for cousin, and that was considered sufficient reason for my having to accept her invitation at about the sixth time of asking. Though why the sins of the father should be visited by the children... You won't find any notepaper in that drawer. That's where I keep old menus and first-night programs. Mrs. Babwald wears a rather solemn personality and has never been known to smile, even when saying disagreeable things to her friends or making out the store's list. She takes her pleasures sadly. A state elephant at a durbar gives one a very similar impression. Her husband gardens in all weathers. When a man goes out in the pouring rain to brush caterpillars off rose trees, I generally imagine his life indoors leaves something to be desired. Anyway, it must be very unsettling for the caterpillars. Of course, there were other people there. There was a major somebody who shot things in Lapland or somewhere of that sort. I forget what they were, but it wasn't for want of reminding. We had them cold with every meal almost, and he was continually giving us details of what they measured from tip to tip, as though he thought we were going to make them warm under things for the winter. I used to listen to him with a rapt attention that I thought rather suited me, and then one day, quite modestly, I gave the dimensions of an okapi I had shot in the Lincolnshire fens. The major turned a beautiful Tyrian scarlet. I remember thinking at the time that I would like my bathroom hung in that color, and I think that at that moment he almost found it in his heart to dislike me. Mrs. Babwald put on a first aid to the injured expression and asked him why he didn't publish a book of his sporting reminiscences. It would be so interesting. She didn't remember till afterwards that he had given her two fat volumes on the subject, with his portrait and autograph as a frontispiece, and an appendix on the habits of the Arctic mussel. It was in the evening that we cast aside the cares and distractions of the day and really lived. Cards were thought to be too frivolous and empty a way of passing the time, so most of them played what they called a book game. You went out into the hall, to get inspiration, I suppose, and then you came back in again, with a muffler tied round your neck and looked silly, and the others were supposed to guess that you were Wee McGregor. I held out against the inanity as long as I decently could, but at last, in a lapse of good nature, I consented to masquerade as a book. Only I warned them that I would take some time to carry it out. They waited the best part of 40 minutes, while I went and played wine glass skittles with the page boy in the pantry. You play it with the champagne cork, you know, and the one who knocks down the most glasses without breaking them wins. I won, with 4 unbroken out of 7. I think William suffered from over-anxiousness. They were rather mad in the drawing room at my not having come back, and they weren't a bit pacified when I told them afterwards that I was at the end of the passage.
"I never did like Kipling," was Mrs. Babwald's comment, when the situation dawned upon her. "I couldn't see anything clever in Earthworms Out of Tuscany. Or is that Darwin?"
Of course, these games are very educational, but personally, I prefer bridge. On Christmas Eve, we were supposed to be specially festive in the old English fashion. The hall was horribly drafty, but it seemed to be the proper place to revel in, and it was decorated with Japanese fans and Chinese lanterns, which gave it a very old English effect. A young lady with a confidential voice flavored us with a long recitation about a little girl who died, or did something equally hackneyed, and then the major gave us a graphic account of a struggle he had with a wounded bear. I privately wished that the bears would win sometimes on these occasions. At least they wouldn't go vaporing about it afterwards. Before we had time to recover our spirits, we were indulged with some thought reading by a young man whom one knew instinctively had a good mother and an indifferent tailor. The sort of young man who talks unflaggingly through the thickest soup and smooths his hair dubiously as though he thought it might hit back. The thought reading was rather a success. He announced that the hostess was thinking about poetry, and she admitted that her mind was dwelling on one of Austin's odes, which was near enough. I fancy she had been really wondering whether a scrag end of mutton and some cold plum pudding would do for the kitchen dinner next day. As a crowning dissipation, they all sat down to play progressive Halma with milk chocolate for prizes. I've been carefully brought up, and I don't like to play games of skill for milk chocolate. So I invented a headache and retired from the scene. I had been preceded a few minutes earlier by Miss Langshan Smith, a rather formidable lady who always got up at some uncomfortable hour in the morning and gave you the impression that she had been in communication with most of the European governments before breakfast. There was a paper pinned on her door with a signed request that she might be called particularly early on the morrow. Such an opportunity does not come twice in a lifetime. I covered up everything except the signature with another notice to the effect that before these words should meet the eye, she would have ended a misspent life, was sorry for the trouble she was giving, and would like a military funeral. A few minutes later, I violently exploded an air-filled paper bag on the landing and gave a stage moan that could have been heard in the cellars. Then I pursued my original intent and went to bed. The noise those people made in forcing open the good lady's door was positively indecorous. She resisted gallantly, but I believe they searched her for bullets for about a quarter of an hour, as if she had been an historic battlefield. I hate traveling on Boxing Day, but one must occasionally do things that one dislikes. And now, Papa Panov's Special Christmas by Leo Tolstoy. It was Christmas Eve, and although it was still afternoon, lights had begun to appear in the shops and houses of the Little Russian village, for the short winter day was nearly over. Excited children scurried indoors, and now only muffled sounds of chatter and laughter escaped from closed shutters. Old Papa Panov, the village shoemaker, stepped outside his shop to take one last look around. The sounds of happiness, the bright lights, and the faint but delicious smells of Christmas cooking reminded him of past Christmas times when his wife was still alive and his own children little. Now they had gone. His usual cheerful face, with the little laughter wrinkles behind the round steel spectacles, looked sad now. But he went back indoors with a firm step, put on his shutters, and set a pot of coffee to heat on the charcoal stove. Then, with a sigh, he settled in his big armchair. Papa Panov did not often read, but tonight he pulled down the big old family Bible, and, slowly tracing the lines with one forefinger, he read again the Christmas story. He read how Mary and Joseph, tired by their journey to Bethlehem, found no room for them in the inn, so that Mary's little baby was born in the cowshed.
Oh, dear," exclaimed Papa Panov. "If only they'd come here, I would have given them my bed, and I could have covered the baby with my patchwork quilt to keep him warm."
He read on about the wise men who had come to see the baby Jesus, bringing him splendid gifts. Papa Panov's face fell.
"I have no gift that I could give him," he thought sadly.
Then his face brightened. He put down the Bible, got up, and stretched his long arms to the shelf high up in his little room. He took down a small, dusty box and opened it. Inside was a perfect pair of tiny leather shoes. Papapanov smiled with satisfaction. Yes, they were as good as he remembered, the best shoes he ever made.
I should give him those, he decided, as he gently put them away and sat down again.
He was feeling tired now, and the further he read, the sleepier he became. The print began to dance before his eyes, so that he closed them just for a minute. In no time at all, Papapanov was fast asleep. And as he slept, he dreamed. He dreamed that someone was in his room, and he knew at once, as one does in dreams, who the person was. It was Jesus.
You have been wishing that you could see me, Papapanov, he said kindly. Then look for me tomorrow. It will be Christmas Day, and I will visit you. But look carefully, for I shall not tell you who I am.
When at last Papapanov awoke, the bells were ringing out, and a thin light was filtering through the shutters.
Bless my soul, said Papapanov. It's Christmas Day.
He stood up and stretched himself, for he was rather stiff. Then his face filled with happiness as he remembered his dream. This would be a very special Christmas after all, for Jesus was coming to visit him. How would he look? Would he be a little baby, as at that first Christmas? Would he be a grown man, a carpenter, or the great king that he is, God's son? He must watch carefully the whole day through so that he recognized him however he came. Papapanov put on a special pot of coffee for his Christmas breakfast, took down the shutters and looked out the window. The street was deserted. No one was stirring yet. No one except the road sweeper. He looked as miserable and dirty as ever. And well he might. Whoever wanted to work on Christmas Day, and in the raw, cold, and bitter freezing mist of such a morning. Papapanov opened the shop door, letting in a thin stream of cold air.
Come in! He shouted across the street cheerily. Come in and have some hot coffee to keep out the cold!
The sweeper looked up, scarcely able to believe his ears. He was only too glad to put down his broom and come into the warm room. His old clothes steamed gently in the heat of the stove, and he clasped both red hands round the comforting warm mug as he drank. Papapanov watched him with satisfaction, but every now and then his eyes strayed to the window. It would never do to miss his special visitor.
"Expecting someone?" the sweeper asked at last.
So Papapanov told him about his dream.
"Well, I hope he comes," the sweeper said. You've given me a bit of Christmas cheer I never expected to have. I'd say you deserve to have your dream come true.
And he actually smiled. When he was gone, Papapanov put on cabbage soup for his dinner, then went to the door again, scanning the street. He saw no one. But he was mistaken. Someone was coming. The girl walked so slowly and quietly, hugging the walls of shops and houses, that it was a while before he noticed her. She looked very tired and was carrying something. As she drew nearer, he could see that it was a baby, wrapped in a thin shawl. There was such sadness in her face and in the pinched little face of the baby that Papapanov's heart went out to them.
Won't you come in?
He called, stepping outside to meet them.
You both need a warm seat by the fire and a rest.
The young mother let him shepherd her indoors and to the comfort of the armchair. She gave a big sigh of relief.
I'll warm some milk for the baby, Papapanov said. I've had children of my own. I can feed her for you.
He took the milk from the stove and carefully fed the baby from a spoon, warming her tiny feet by the stove at the same time.
She needs shoes, the cobbler said.
But the girl replied, I can't afford shoes. I've got no husband to bring home money. I'm on my way to the next village to get work. A sudden thought flashed through Papapanov's mind. He remembered the little shoes he had looked at last night. But he had been keeping those for Jesus. He looked again at the cold little feet and made up his mind.
Try these on her,
he said, handing the baby and the shoes to the mother. The beautiful little shoes were a perfect fit. The girl smiled happily, and the baby gurgled with pleasure.
You have been so kind to us, the girl said, when she got up with her baby to go. May all your Christmas wishes come true.
But Papapanov was beginning to wonder if his very special Christmas wish would come true. Perhaps he had missed his visitor. He looked anxiously up and down the street. There were plenty of people about, but they were all faces that he recognized. There were neighbors going to call on their families. They nodded and smiled and wished him happy Christmas, or beggars, and Papapanov hurried indoors to fetch them hot soup and a generous hunk of bread, hurrying out in case he missed the important stranger. All too soon the winter dusk fell. When Papapanov next went to the door and strained his eyes, he could no longer make out the passers-by. Most were home and indoors by now anyway. He walked slowly back into his room at last, put up the shutters, and sat down wearily in his armchair. So it had been just a dream after all. Jesus had not come. Then all at once he knew that he was no longer alone in the room. This was not a dream, for he was wide awake. At first he seemed to see before his eyes the long stream of people who had come to him that day. He saw again the old road sweeper, the young mother and her baby, and the beggars he had fed. As they passed, each whispered, "Didn't you see me, Papapanov?"
"Who are you?"
he called out, bewildered. Then another voice answered him. It was the voice from his dream, the voice of Jesus. "I was hungry, and you fed me," he said. "I was naked, and you clothed me. I was cold, and you warmed me. I come to you today in every one of those you helped and welcomed." Then all was quiet and still. Only the sound of the big clock ticking. A great peace and happiness seemed to fill the room, overflowing Papapanov's heart, until he wanted to burst out singing and laughing and dancing with joy.
"So he did come after all,"
was all that he said. And those are our little Christmas stories for you this evening. I hope you enjoyed them. Thank you for sharing my 100th episode with me. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.